I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. To the very last, his timing was impeccable.
The men of Normandy had faith that what they were doing was right, faith that they fought for all humanity, faith that a just God would grant them mercy on this beachhead or on the next. It was the deep knowledge, and pray God we have not lost it, that there is a profound moral difference between the use of force for liberation and the use of force for conquest. You were here to liberate, not to conquer. And so you and those others did not doubt your cause. And you were right not to doubt.
President Reagan died almost 20 years to the hour of delivering that tribute to the men who died saving the world from Hitler's Nazis. He didn't fight in World War II. He was too nearsighted for combat. But decades later, he fought its legacy, the Cold War, and many, including Margaret Thatcher, believe he alone deserves credit for winning it. He's also credited with starting a revolution at home, redefining his party and reshaping America in his own image. Idealistic, traditional, conservative, optimistic, and proud. Reagan was all those things, and witty and charming too. He was dismissed by many as a lightweight, a former B actor who could deliver a script with both gravitas and a light touch. Being underestimated may have been his greatest strength. Nobody sees him as a simpleton today. All the Republican heavyweights, from President Bush down, are embracing his legacy and claiming they're its natural heirs. Connection listeners, is America still Reagan's America 16 years after he left the White House? And where do you see his legacy today? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests today are Bruce Shulman, who's Professor of History and American Studies at Boston University. Marty Nolan is longtime reporter and columnist with the Boston Globe, who covered Reagan both as governor of California and president. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Professor Shulman, if I can start with you, just remind us of the country that Reagan inherited.
Well, Reagan, of course, came to the presidency in 1980 at the end of a decade of many, many disappointments in American life. The Watergate scandal, the defeat and retreat from Vietnam, the collapse of the great long ride of post-World War II economic prosperity that had done so much for so many people, and now there was inflation, stagnation, high unemployment, high gas prices at the same time. And, of course, also, he came at the end of a period in which Americans had relied on their government to provide some form of economic security and some form of social justice, the great civil rights revolution being the most important example. And so, but that faith in government was beginning to erode.
Mm-hmm. Well, indeed, in his first inaugural, let's have a listen to it, because in his first inaugural, he said that people think of government as being the solution, but government is the problem. And here he is saying what he's going to do about it.
Those who do work are denied a fair return for their labor by a tax system which penalizes successful achievement and keeps us from maintaining full productivity. But great as our tax burden is, it has not kept pace with public spending. For decades, we have piled deficit upon deficit, mortgaging our future and our children's future for the temporary convenience of the present. To continue this long trend is to guarantee tremendous social, cultural, political, and economic upheavals.
So he was putting forward an idea of positive conservatism, as it's been said, and smaller government. Marty Nolan, did you have this feeling, though, that he really had this vision, that this was encapsulated in this man through all the years you were following his career?
Oh, yes. No one thinks that he really was just reading somebody else's script. He believed in what he wrote. During the time between his being governor of California and president, he did a lot of radio talks. In fact, he innovated the famous Saturday afternoon radio speech, which other presidents have dealt with less successfully. And recently at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, Martin Anderson, several others, uncovered his scripts. He wrote them in his own hand, you know. This idea that he was a dummy, or in the words of Clark Clifford, who was President Truman's advisor and LBJ's advisor, an amiable dunce. Oh, that was just not true. Whatever, you don't have to agree with him, and I certainly didn't. But he was an intelligent, shrewd, dynamic leader.
And it's obvious from the way you talk about him, you really like the guy.
Oh, well, yes, he's a day at the beach compared to a lot of politicians. I mean, I made the strategic decision to talk about him, the movies with him rather than anything else. I didn't care what he thought about the Salt Treaty or Panama Canal, neither did he when I got the chance to talk about movies.
There you are, Professor Shulman. He's coming into office with a clear vision of what he wants. Is this Reagan alone? Would you like to put him into context? I mean, are we just talking about a Reagan revolution, or was it a gradual process and he was the man of the time?
Well, I'd like to call it, in some ways, the Reagan culmination rather than the Reagan revolution. That is, Reagan really represents the culmination of the rise to power of a conservative movement and a conservative way of looking at the world that's been developing at least since the mid-1960s. Reagan entered national politics during the 1964 election when he gave a famous and famously effective speech on behalf of Barry Goldwater. That's what, in fact, got many people in California excited about the idea of making him a candidate for governor in 2 years later in 1966. But so in some ways that he is able to pull together certain things. The tax revolt that is spreading across the nation out of his native California, reaching as far as Massachusetts and many other states. The post-Vietnam worries about the place of the United States in the world and its seemingly declining power in the world economically and diplomatically, and wanting to reassert that. And also a kind of reaction to the 1960s and 1970s countercultural experiments and the introduction of a new kind of morality in American life, and wanting to speak up for people who are uncomfortable with certain aspects of those changes. So the conservative movement had these different threads, and he was able to, in a very unstable but effective way, pull together these sometimes contradictory elements of American conservatism and forge them into a winning movement and coalition.
Marty, would it be, well, not wrong to sort of put together his film career with his political career? Because here he was, a guy whose ideology seemed to be talking for the little guy, the homespun wisdom that you take on the bad guys, and the bad guys are the commies in the Cold War. I mean, can the two be sort of gelled together? You talked a lot to him about the movies.
Well, yes, he identified with the good guys. Obviously, he played his last movie ever. He played a bad guy. He did it as a favor to Lou Wasson. It's a very good movie, The Killers, in which he played a heel, but he's very proud of the cast. He was in Lee Marvin, John Cassavetes, Angie Dickinson. But he always liked to play the good guy. But in the Republican Party, he identified with the little guy. You know, he was not Wall Street's favorite. If you look, in fact, Wall Street, in his presidency, was still fretting about the trade deficit and the budget deficit, and that's what led to the crash of 1987. He wasn't, shall we say, the candidate of the Edward Arnolds and the Lionel Barrymores and the plutocrat types on Wall Street, but he was the little guy. If you think of It's a Wonderful Life, a movie of his pal Jimmy Stewart, he was with the little depositors, not the big bankers, and he inspired those entrepreneurs by cutting their taxes. Now, good or bad, a lot of bad side effects, but certainly that approach to prosperity was better than the traditional Wall Street approach.
Now, the really interesting thing today is that today's President Bush, President Bush II, is claiming the legacy, the bigwigs in the party claiming the legacy, Tom DeLay saying we're carrying the torch of Reaganism. I'd like to introduce Lauren Truesdale. She's a junior at Harvard. She's secretary and spokesperson of the Harvard Republican Club. And Lauren, I hope you don't mind me mentioning that you were born in 1984, which was at the beginning of Reagan's second term, and yet his death really hit you, didn't it?
Yes, I mean, definitely throughout my life I've seen the effects of Reagan that he's had on the party, that he's had on my life. I mean, I didn't, obviously being born in 84, experience his leadership. I don't remember seeing his policies in action, but he's become such a part of our culture and such a part of, you know, the party's ideology that today the Reagan legacy is inescapable.
How would you define that legacy, Lauren? You're saying you're looking at America and you're seeing Reagan's America. How would you define it?
I would define it as a legacy of strength and of kind of singularity of purpose, both in Reagan's domestic policy, I think, and in his foreign policy. We saw a great strength, a great way of saying, you know, America, we're the good guys. We are the ones, we have such great power in our citizens, in our ability to stand up for what we believe in our ability to work hard. And I mean, I see that today. You know, you look at President Bush's foreign policy now, and you see, you know, strength being asserted in foreign policy and saying America's in the right here. And you see that domestically too, seeing, you know, the Bush tax cuts. You see kind of looking out for the taxpayer and the strength that Americans have in working, and definitely is carrying on the Reagan legacy.
And does it matter to be a really strong leader? Is that what he had most of all, that he had a clear vision?
Definitely. His leadership is, I think, the greatest quality of Reagan. It's one thing to have many good ideas. It's another to execute them. And that was something that Reagan really succeeded in, is having these great ideas and saying, okay, we're not just going to sit around anymore. We're not going to let this kind of, you know, the memories of the quagmire of Vietnam and the memories of kind of stagflation, we're not going to let these overwhelm us. We're going to move ahead. And that's his greatest legacy.
Lauren, just one thought. A lot of those adjectives, a lot of the description you're using for Reagan could be applied to George W. Bush, could it not? Why not idolize George W. Bush, our current president?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, many young Republicans today do idolize the president. But we see Reagan as kind of this mythical figure. He was the one who brought conservatism into its contemporary form. Right now, we see there was sort of, after looking at Johnson and looking at Carter, we see Reagan as the one who sort of distilled our policies into this looking at the strength of the American people and our focus and our hard work, and he brought modern conservatism into being what it is now. He's kind of the founding father of Bush's policies.
Lauren, do stay with us. I'd like to have a brief word with Professor Shulman about that. Modern conservatism, is it a direct line? Goldwater goes through Reagan. He really focused it, and then you take it into Bush, and he's carrying it on?
Well, I think in important ways, Bush is the legatee of Reagan's presidency. Certainly the emphasis on low taxes and on freeing business, looking to the entrepreneur rather than the government as the agent of social change. He's also a legatee in that he's not really, he talks about small government, but he is not a president of small government, and neither was Reagan, really. I mean, Reagan expanded the size of government. He added a new cabinet department. He didn't keep his promise to eliminate two. Also, I think, though, an interesting difference is that Reagan's success was that he understood the limits of his own and his nation's power. Sometimes he spoke loudly but carried a small stick, such as when he retreated from Lebanon in 1983.
We'll come up to foreign policy after the break. Professor Shulman, Marty Nolan, thanks for the moment. Lauren Truesdale, thanks very much for joining us. You join in the conversation. Is today's America Reagan's America? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking Reagan this hour and asking, is America today still Reagan's America? 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Nate's calling us from Newport News, Virginia. Nate, hi.
Yes, how do you do? Thanks for taking my call. I think it's pretty clear that that this is still, in a lot of senses, Reagan's America. And I would like to, in my opinion anyway, that the results of this, at least economically, are catastrophic. We are still paying for the Reagan budget deficits. And if anybody who wants to question whether or not George W. Bush, you know, President 43, is the product of Reagan, the inheritor of the Reagan legacy, that's absolutely true, because he is making them much worse.
Well, Nate, I mean, the deficit was wiped off in between times, but Reagan was fighting the Cold War, and George W. Bush would argue he's fighting the war on terror. Clinton had an easy 8 years.
Well, that's there are a lot of people who would argue that that was not true. There were already economic forces in place that were bound to drive the Soviet Union into the ground. It was only a matter of time. And George Bush, with regard to the war on terror, particularly if we're talking about economics, the war in Iraq, this is the first war in the history of the entire nation in which we decided to go to war and then enacted tax cuts. Hideously irresponsible and cowardly.
Nate, thanks for your point. I should have mentioned after the break that my guests are Marty Nolan, former political columnist for the Boston Globe, and Professor Bruce Shulman, Professor of History and American Studies at Boston University. But to answer Nate's point there, I'd like to bring in another guest, Howell Raines, who's former executive editor of the New York Times. Howell Raines, do you agree with Nate's point?
Up to a point, I should say. I was trying to think what I could say that would be additive to the good discussion from your guest and from this caller. Now, I would say in regard to the caller's point, the American people are getting to buy down the Reagan deficits twice, as you pointed out, first during the Clinton years, and now that Bush has driven them up again, presumably they will have to be bought down again at some point. The analysis that war costs have driven it absent other factors is one that I disagree with very strongly, because the core idea of Reaganomics was, in the beginning, to squeeze down taxes, strangling the government's revenues so that the size of the government would inevitably have to shrink because it was being starved. The other side of Reaganomics, of course, was the theory that that tax cuts would generate supplemental revenue for that was disappearing, but we found that wasn't the case with the Reagan deficits. Now, in the Bush administration, I think, you're getting at a time of even greater cost, tax cuts that are doctrinaire and that have the same motivation, which is to shrink the government by strangling off its revenue sources. So that's the reason the costs are relatively constant, are constantly rising. So when you cut taxes, you cut the revenues, and deficits have to soar because you've got to get the money from somewhere.
How this is Marty Nolan.
Hi, Marty.
How you doing?
Good.
You remember when another great son of the late Confederacy, Fritz Hollings, was running for president in 1984, and he had a very simple explanation. He said, Reagan, he's just spent all the money. That's all he's done. Right?
And cut the revenues for
it. He knows how to take care of this government. He just spends all the money.
The guy who really paid for the Reagan deficits, of course, was the first George Bush, who had to raise taxes, reneging on his no new taxes pledge, and ended up losing an election in part because of that. And I think the current George W. Bush, these are, I think Howell is absolutely right, doctrinaire tax cuts, and one of the great political benefits of them is the cost of paying them down politically are going to fall on his successors.
But Howell Raines, where do you see his legacy? Because he promoted positive conservatism. He had been a Democrat. He'd voted three times for FDR. Did he in some way, with his positive conservatism, perhaps compassionate conservatism, take up the legacy of FDR?
In an odd sort of way, and as I was listening to the discussion, I'm thinking one of the interesting things about Reagan is, like his role model, Franklin D. Roosevelt, he invites us to think of history in broad themes. But there's always, as in both administrations, both the New Deal and the Reagan Revolution, complexity beneath the surface. For example, let's stipulate Reagan had a major role in ending the Cold War, in restoring American confidence, in restoring the market economy that is the great economic engine of this country. On the other side, the conservatism was not very compassionate, however. I think it's fair to say that Reagan really started the coarsening of the social conscience in America in such a way that our social welfare system is inferior to that of many industrialized democracies with less wealth than we have. We still have 45 million people with no health insurance. I think there's something like 30 million children living in poverty.
But Professor,
let me just one more thing. How does that link to Reaganism? Reagan's first budget, he raised military spending, as I recall, by over $25 billion. In that same period, they were kicking blind people and people in wheelchairs off of Social Security disability benefits. So you have this kind of double bind where, although America is more prosperous as a result of Reagan, we have the most unfair tax system and the most inequitable distribution of wealth that we've ever had.
Professor Shulman, do you go along with that?
Largely. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about Reagan is that alone among the industrial democracies of the modern world, I mean, including Mrs. Thatcher's England, Reagan's America does not cut entitlement programs that go to everyone when it's trying to cut budgets, but it cuts means-tested programs for the very poor. That's where the cuts come. Even Mrs. Thatcher made her more substantial cuts in the health and pension benefits that went to everyone, and in fact gave more resources to the means-tested benefits for the very poor. So I think that is one of the that's one of the sides of the Reagan Revolution that you have to look at. It was that Reagan, warm and genial and fun-loving as he was, did not seem to be able to find empathy for people less fortunate for himself, and his attitudes toward the homeless and his very slow recognition of the dimensions of the AIDS crisis, I think, are also important aspects of that cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, but how, Reince, do you think this was learning on the job or, you know, having to make compromises on the job? Or do you think that from the start he knew exactly where he was going and he said, I promise tax cuts, I promise low deficits. Of course, he didn't manage all of that, but that he knew there were going to have to be some sacrifices. He didn't mention them, or he just had to make sacrifices as he went along?
I think that Reagan was a man who made the wise executive decision that a president can only accomplish one, two, or three big things, and that the chief executive has to ignore a lot of things, including things that make me as a political liberal unhappy. But I think the core to Reagan's course setting was that he is a man who valued belief over facts. So his great belief that if he put the country on this broad economic and national security path, that the country would be more secure in the long run, over trumped any amount of factual information you could bring him, for example, about the poor on Social Security or about medical care in this country.
I'm sure Howell remembers that in Detroit at the 1980 Republican Convention, Reagan's acceptance speech mentioned Franklin D. Roosevelt 7, 8, 9 times. You know, so what party's convention are we at here? And he did that deliberately because he was setting himself up as the counter to Roosevelt. All the previous Republican presidents and candidates didn't believe in deregulation. Eisenhower, Nixon said, "Nah, it's not worth doing that. We can't fight that. Let's fight some other battle."
So you're saying that he knew he was going to dismantle the New Deal, but he can't say exactly
what he was doing, and he had it all written. He said, "I'm going to lower your taxes, and I'm going to blacken the sky with missiles and planes, and it'll defeat the Soviet Union." And there was no more stunning comment than I saw from Senator Ted Kennedy, who said history will give him credit for ending the Cold War. Wow. You would get an argument among most liberal circles on that one, but Kennedy just said it flat out.
I wouldn't argue with that, Marty. I think Senator Kennedy is right about that, and I think...
But at the time, Howell, you remember, you couldn't get anyone to say that in 1989, say.
No, but, you know, one of the things that's interesting here is Reagan followed his instinct in raising American defense spending to such a point that it basically collapsed the Soviet economy. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting about that is he was acting on belief. The factual information, factual in quotes, that was being presented to him by the CIA was that the Soviet economy was 4 to 5 times more productive than it really was.
Howell Raines, thanks very much for joining. I'd like to get some more people into the conversation. 1-800-423-8255 to talk about Reagan's legacy. Nancy's joining us from Newton, Mass. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And bear with me. I'm a little nervous. I'm a first caller. I've been watching the, you know, and listening to the news and looking at all the great things that that they talk about that he did and his legacy. And I can remember going through his era was the many crimes that his and his administration committed in Latin America and throughout the Middle East and all part of the world. I would remind you that under his administration, there were 22 invasions, 4 major wars. And remember that he fired 10,000 air traffickers, and it messed up, I mean, screwed up our air traffic. And just to ignore completely and misinform the younger generation that have not gone through that era, that about what his legacy was. Elliot Abraham, that who is serving in Bush administration now, he should be put in jail for crimes he committed in Iran-Contra affairs.
Nancy, what you're saying there is talking about ideological foreign policy. Marty, can you see this line going from Reagan to Bush, ideological foreign policy? And in Reagan's mind, the front line of communism was in Latin America.
Oh, and he was not only, you know, disgracefully wrong on it, but as Talleyrand would say, it's worse than a crime, a blunder. It didn't work, you know, and it was not a good idea. I agree with Nancy from Newton. But just to illustrate, when she mentioned the air traffic controllers, you know where much of his idea came from on that, much of his thinking. In an episode of Death Valley Days, in which he played Admiral David Glasgow Farragut, whose statue stands here in South Boston looking at the Atlantic, who was dispatched to San Francisco Bay to take care of the vigilante movement that was going on after the gold rush. And there's Reagan in his full U.S. Navy uniform threatening to turn the guns of the American fleet on these vigilantes unless they surrendered. And it's just like the air traffic controllers. He loved his roles. He believed in his roles.
But he had been a sort of union official in the Screenwriters Guild, had he not? Is that where...
And a very liberal one. And he was before he got hooked up with the House Un-American Activities Committee, he was very much a flaming liberal fighting the studio bosses.
The Patco strike, the crushing of the Patco strike, also had an impact on far more than that one labor union, because employers throughout the United States took that as a signal that they could clamp down on union labor and get away with it, in fact, be encouraged to do so. And you can see a much more aggressive anti-union tactics by employers and part of the decline of the labor movement after the Patco.
We're talking Reagan's legacy this hour, 1-800-423-8255-800-423-TALK. Gentlemen, I think Mark, calling us from Raleigh in North Carolina, would like to disagree with your characterization of Reagan. Mark, hi, what's your point?
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call. I disagree with Marty. I think he's seriously misguided, and he's not taking into consideration the state of the nation when Reagan took over as president. I was maybe 16 at the time, and when he took on the presidency, it was a time when I remember being young, the hostages being in Iran, and my parents having to line up at 5 in the morning to get gas, and the nation was in disarray. And I remember looking forward to turning 18 so I could vote for him a second time, because he gave us pride in our nation that we didn't have before. Their characterization of the Patco, you know, how Reagan handled that and how it affected the labor movement, I think turned out to really be a good thing, because it stopped the paternalization of companies and made employees and employers more accountable for themselves in the workplace.
Do you think, you know, things were better for you that in Reagan's America, that opportunities for a young guy like you, there were greater opportunities, that the poor had more chance? Was it just a feeling, or was it real?
It was real. It was real. My father worked for IBM for a whole long time, but when the economy was going south, IBM went from being the fraternal organization that it was, paternal, I should say, and they started shedding labor, and my father was one of the buyouts. But my brother and I actually went to go work for IBM at a point in time, and there was more accountability, and, you know, we took more responsibilities for our careers and didn't see it as, you know, starting with a company and staying with them till you retired. And I think that was a good thing, and I think it made us more productive as a nation. Whether it led to the offshoring of jobs right now, I can't speak to that.
Mark, thanks very much for your call. Professor Shulman, is that part of his legacy and the most important part? I mean, you talked about him, you know, not being sympathetic to the poor, but, you know, was this hard-nosed economic saying that if you make this country rich, it trickles down to the poor and you privatize.
Well, I think that in some ways Reagan's most important contributions come in the realm of ideas and national mood, even more so than in public policy, where the record was fully mixed. I mean, he, I think, unleashes a cultural change as much as a political change, a regional change, too, is the kind of shift in the center of gravity in American life from the old Eastern establishment to a more wide-open, libertarian, sunbelt, cowboy style of American life. I mean, you know, in the popularity of things like country music and stock car racing and the presidency of George W. Bush, I mean, come out of this cultural shift as well.
Marty, I'd like to, you know, a point we'd like to bring up after the break, but is this part of the reason that he made the Republican Party so much stronger, because it was a broader house for the poorer, for the blue-collar worker? You get the Reagan Democrats.
Well, he invented the Reagan Democrats, and that's why he went to Detroit to accept the nomination. And Professor Shulman alluded to it earlier. We had 20 years of unfinished presidencies. I mean, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter. And Carter, particularly, a wonderful ex-president, finest since John Quincy Adams, but he introduced malaise. In fact, he didn't. It was one of his spin doctors. As you know, you can't get anything done. These Americans, they're ungovernable. And Reagan said, I can do it and still take an afternoon nap.
Professor Sherman, just briefly, was a lot of it luck as well, that Americans really wanted stability, they wanted to feel good, and he was the man of the moment with the right ideas for the time?
Well, I don't know. I don't think that's luck. I mean, I think he may have been the man at the moment, but I think he made his own luck in that respect. And so I don't think that, I mean, if you can imagine the other people in the political universe at the time in 1976, 1980, Gerald Ford, Nelson Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, that was the Republican Party. Could they have done it? I don't think so.
Connection listeners, where do you see Reagan's legacy? Join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow, in for Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking Reagan this hour and asking, is the America we're living in today still Reagan's America? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. My guests in the studio are Bruce Shulman, Professor of History and American Studies at Boston University, and Martin Nolan, reporter and columnist with the Boston Globe, covered Reagan for years, many more than you probably care to remember. And let me also introduce now Harvey Mansfield, professor of government at Harvard and an expert on conservatism in America. Professor Mansfield, we've been talking about how Reagan changed the face of conservatism. How did he do it? What was his conservatism?
Well, in the first place, he put conservatism into practice. He made it work, or he made it at least seem to work to conservatives. And you should know, and it's been clear so far in this hour, that his legacy is alive with part of America, but the other part of America, the liberal half, is still very much opposed to him. So he was a partisan president, and his conservatism was a partisan conservatism. It differed from previous conservatism. It was more democratic. I think Reagan democratized conservatism. It made it seem not such an elite doctrine as it had been before.
But what you seem to be saying is that it was more conservative conservatism if he alienated the liberals. Then how did he make the Republican Party a much broader camp if he was alienating part of the party?
Well, he made it seem, as I said, more democratic, and therefore not just the preserve of a few. And he also Americanized it. It wasn't just a traditional doctrine that there was a kind of golden age or better time in the past that we should try to return to. No, he was very much for the future. And that meant that he could appeal to everyone who believed in the future. If you didn't have a lot of money or high status right now, you or your children might have it in the future. So his...
What would you say were the bullet points? I mean, what was it? Strong family values, law-abiding citizens, religious fundamentalists, underlining it?
I don't think so. Those were features of his conservatism, but the main points were a new freedom. You could call it a market philosophy, except that he didn't use the word market very often. But he thought that the spontaneous activity and choices of individuals would produce a better and more rational, more productive result than something regulated and planned by government. That was his domestic policy. And then his foreign policy was also a departure from conservative orthodoxy. He thought that the United States should go on the offensive in the Cold War. That's what Henry Kissinger said about him. And Henry Kissinger was Reagan's great target, I think.
Yeah, and who do you think is actually carrying the Reagan brand today, Professor Mansfield? Because, of course, they're all claiming it. President Bush, Newt Gingrich did, Tom DeLay did, the neocons did, John McCain did, you know, in 2000. Who actually does carry the Reagan brand?
Well, as far as foreign policy goes, I think George Bush's doctrine of a forward strategy in the war on terror reminds one quite a bit, I think, of Reagan's offensive strategy in the Cold War. Both of them, both of those doctrines were adopted against the advice of most intellectuals and most experts in the field, and also of the Department of State. And I think George Bush's boldness, I think, owes a good deal to the success of Reagan's boldness in the Cold War.
Professor Mansfield, good. Let's hear from our connection listeners, see what they think about that. 1-800-43-8255, 800-423-TALK is how you join us. Justin's calling from Greensboro in North Carolina. Justin, you want to compare Reagan with today's crop?
Yeah, I was just the main thing that I've noticed is that Reagan was very strong. I'm also born in 1984, so it was a little bit before my time. But from studying of it, I've noticed he was very strong in, you know, what he believed in. It was very clear, you know, as a voter going into the election, you knew if you were voting for Reagan, what you were voting for. But in today's election, you know, as a voter, I don't really know, you know, what's the difference between Bush or Kerry, except for the fact that Kerry is an anti-Bush candidate and Bush is an anti-Kerry candidate. There's not really any, you know, any noticeable difference. You know, and I think that's, you know, one of the biggest problems in, you know, the state of voting in America today is that no one really has any idea the difference between the candidates because no one really has a platform that they stand for. It's only that, you know, the only platform that they stand on is that they want to be elected.
Yeah, Marty, is that a point that Reagan was not a negative guy? Reagan,
oh, no. He never demonized an opponent that I ever knew of. He's unlike these pygmies today who are just doing opposition research all the time. I don't think Reagan ever looked at two sentences of opposition research. He could figure out why he should be elected rather than the other guy. And he told David Brinkley it just before he left the presidency. He said, you know, David, I used to wonder how an actor could become president. Now, I don't know how you become president without being an actor because you have to deal with so many different people. And he also said in his wonderful, candid way, he said, I'll tell you, sincerity, once you can fake that, you've got it made. And that was how disarming he was. And that just was the velvet glove over this very firm iron belief he had in a few basic principles.
Yeah, but Justin, you know, discard the negative campaigning for the moment. Isn't George Bush a guy who is very clear about where he's going? I mean, this is a guy who said you're with us or you're against us. You can't be clearer than that.
Well, that's true. He does, you know, he's very clear about you're with us or against us. But as far as his policy goes, it's very, and, you know, as far as, you know, deciding which candidate, you know, should, you know, you want to put your vote in and you want to elect to be our next president, you know, you really don't know, you know, what's the difference? Like, where does Kerry stand on, you know, in opposition to any of Bush's policies? Like, he hasn't made clear in the election what he plans to change. You know, he's been, you know, very, you know, outspoken against the war, but he has made no, you know, clear distinction. distinction on what his plans are if he was elected. You know, what would he do with the troops? He's, you know, he hasn't said, you know, I want to take them out, I want to keep them in. It's just been, you know, I disagree with what Bush is doing. And, you know, the same thing with Bush. He's been kind of unclear. It's kind of been, you know, like walking on thin ice because we're not really sure, you know, what's going to happen. And it just, it makes it hard, you know, between two candidates, who are you supposed to choose? And I feel like, you know, this is going to be my first time voting, sort of disillusioned, and I kind of don't understand how anyone cannot be disillusioned, you know, in the state of politics today.
Justin, thanks very much. Professor Shulman, is that his greatest legacy and they're ignoring it, is that he redefined the presidency?
Well, certainly he redefined the presidency. I'd also think you need to add to your list of the people who claim the mantle of Reagan of conspicuous omission, and that's Bill Clinton. I mean, Bill Clinton balanced the budget. Bill Clinton said the era of big government is over. Bill Clinton ended welfare as we know it. So what Bill Clinton did, I mean, were kinds of things that the Reaganites were dreaming of in the early 1980s. Now the standard bearer of the Democratic Party is the candidate of fiscal conservatism. So that shows, I mean, Professor Mansfield maybe was partly wrong in saying that half of the country still rejects Reagan, because the whole spectrum has shifted to the right, and that was an important legacy. But to get back to your question, certainly he revived the institution of the presidency at a time when people thought that it was in great decline. And one of the ways he did it was through his skill as a communicator, which turned out to be not superficial, but essential to what a president does, being able to formulate not only policy and legislation, but big ideas and transmit them to the country and the world, turns out to be, in the age of mass media, one of the most important parts of the job substantively.
Absolutely, Marty. I mean, we tend to talk about him as the great communicator in almost derogatory terms, like this is the guy being the actor. But is that an important part of his legacy? I mean, I know in Britain, Tony Blair openly admitted that he was, in many respects, copying Margaret Thatcher's style.
Well, we've been so conditioned by policy wonk candidates that everything has to be nuanced and weighed and all this. Well, try this one. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Not much nuance there. Not much, you know, let's hold this up to the light again. I mean, simplicity, there's something to be said for it. And that's and to get along after 5 o'clock and have a drink with Tip O'Neill after they bashed each other's head in all day. I mean, people look back fondly on that, I think.
800-423-8255 to join the conversation. Mark is calling from Fuquay-Ravina in,
yes,
North Carolina. Mark, hi. What would you like to ask our guests?
Well, I'm curious. I don't have anything but pleasant memories of President Reagan. I'm 36 years old. I think he was an outstanding president, and I think President Bush is as well. This is my thought. I just don't think what President Reagan accomplished in the 80s would go over today in America, and I don't know if that's a result of a change in voter demographic. I think what he really accomplished, he conveyed to Americans he wanted them to be successful, and he felt like it was his job as president to create the conditions where they could be successful. But he was not at all in favor of, you know, egalitarianism, which I just don't think the voting public, and I'm looking back at the 2000 election, I don't think there are enough people in America that would be satisfied with a president that saw his role in that light. I'm just interested in particularly what the scholar you got that's...
Okay, Mark, let's put it to the scholar I got, who's Professor Shulman. Professor, what do you say to that?
Well, do you think, Mark, that the current President Bush has a different approach to economic policy than Reagan did, that he wasn't really trying to sort of strip down government regulation and taxes and maximize opportunity? Certainly he portrays his domestic presidency in very much Reaganite light. So are you saying that he's not really in that?
No, I think that he is a great deal like President Reagan. I know, you know, the argument can be made that he's not, you know, based on the way spending has gone, and also, you know, the federal government's not really a whole lot smaller now, almost 4 years later.
I think he's a lot like President Reagan. I'm just thinking about the popular vote from 2000.
Reagan didn't have very much difficulty in his two election victories. Professor Shulman knows, you know, it's kind of rare for people to reelect a president in this great republic we have. And in order to get reelected, you have to have accomplished something. In 1984, mourning in America, after a very tough economic recession in 1982, in which he sustained heavy losses in the Republican Congress, he stuck with his program. He didn't panic. It wasn't like, oh, our polls are bad this week again.
Yeah, but he expanded federal government. This is the guy who said...
Of course he did.
Of course.
And the Social Security said, well, we better raise that Social Security tax, right? He worked with the Democrats and Tip O'Neill and Pat Moynihan, people like that. He said, well, we better get something done about this. So of course, you know, he knew how to rise above principle when he had to, and because he wasn't wedded to any sort of ideology. The important thing to remember, he became governor of California when he was 55 years old. He already had a life. He didn't become president in order to be somebody. He already was somebody. He became president in order to do something.
Professor Mansfield, a final word from you. First of all, if Reagan ran today, would he win? And was he a great president?
Yes, I think he would win rather easily if he ran today. He had a great gift for... simplifying, as was said before, and representing with his actors' experience, he knew how to represent an idea that that George Bush doesn't have. I do think that that he would win again.
Professor Mansfield, we'll have to leave it there. Harvey Mansfield, professor of government at Harvard. My thanks too to Bruce Shulman, Marty Nolan, Hal Raines, and Lauren Truesdale. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection. Let's go out on the Gipper.
My friends, we did it. We weren't just marking time. We made a difference. We made the city stronger. We made the city freer. And we left her in good hands. All in all, not bad. Not bad at all. And so, goodbye. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.